The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the MadTech Podcast. I'm John Still, ExchangeWire's Head of Content, and today I'm delighted, as always, to be joined by ExchangeWire COO, Lindsay Rowntree. Welcome, Lindsay.
Hello. Feels like it's been a while. Good to be back.
I was going to say, lovely to have you back. It has been a few weeks.
Yeah, I've missed it.
Good. Well, your insights are always valuable and you are welcome as always. So the FIFA Women's World Cup is only a few weeks away. And after England's victory in last year's Euros made household names of Beth Mead, Jill Scott, Lucy Bronze and the team, today we're going to take a special look at how the media and commercial opportunities around the game have grown. To do so, I'm thrilled to say we're joined by an expert in that field, Charlotte Thompson, Head of Women's Football for Copper 90. Charlotte, welcome to the podcast. Really nice to have you on.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, excited to be here.
Cool. Well, we're going to look at three stories as usual, but they're going to stick on the women football theme and look at the opportunities around it. So we'll start with DAZN and YouTube and how the channel is having a positive effect on women's football. A new report published by the sports streaming service DAZN has found that its DAZN UWCL YouTube channel has driven awareness across the women's game. The Value and Impact report, which was carried out by Crux Sports, found that use of YouTube to promote the UEFA Women's Champions League has helped the competition and its participants to grow in popularity. The report, which combined data analysis and stakeholder interviews, also established that the partnership has improved the commercial viability of women's football, with 77% of clubs reporting that they've seen an uplift in sponsor interest. So I'll throw this to you first, Charlotte. And in a more general sense, seeing how the game has grown, particularly since the Euros last year, and the effect that wider streaming services and media is having on the women's game, how have you seen that develop?
I think the thing here is visibility is key. I don't think personally there's ever necessarily been a lack of interest in women's football, but there has been a lack of visibility from a very UK point of view, before BBC and Sky took the WSL, you could only see it on BT Sport, which is subscription. But then on top of that, the season was all over the place. So it was really hard to follow. So when you've got the likes of BBC and Sky making it easier to watch, especially BBC being free to air, and then on top of that, the likes of DAZN and YouTube making it free to air, it just makes such a difference. And we're seeing that both at matches where we're seeing record attendances. I strongly believe that next season or in a few seasons' time, we're not going to see headlines saying record attendance at, because that just starts to be the norm. We're seeing it from a domestic level. We saw it internationally. So the AFCON women's final had a record attendance. We're seeing the likes of Arsenal selling out the Emirates for Champions League games. So that knock on is happening both on the pitch, but then also when you're looking at viewing figures as well, you can see that happening. But it's just, you know, you're showing it. It's that visibility. I think beyond that, it's not just about making it visible. It's about all the work that the likes of DAZN and the other broadcasters have done around the game to market it so well. You can't just kind of put it on and expect people to show up and know that it's there. I think that's especially true with the likes of DAZN and YouTube, where you have to make a very active decision to log on to YouTube, to search the game and to go and find it, where I guess that the difference for the likes of BBC or Sky is you will catch the sort of casual viewers just flicking through and seeing what's on TV. So you don't necessarily have that discovery. But what they've done is, what I think is really clever, is how they've marketed the game with campaigns like This Is Elite. They're not talking about women's football in the PG watered down version that we used to talk about it. It is no longer a good cause. We're talking about the great entertainment that it is. And I think that has made such a difference as well, because now football fans, historic football fans, are now looking at women's football as a place for them. I think historically how women's football was marketed was very family friendly, PG, isn't this nice? We're providing opportunities for grassroots girls to play. I always say that like it's a bad thing. It's not a bad thing, but it can't be. Obviously, we want young girls to play football, but it can't be the only thing, because established football fans just won't see it, won't see women's football as a place for them. So I think they've been very clever in the way they marketed it. And I guess the third thing that I would add to that is how they've been very clever with their partnerships, the deal that they did with Adidas, and how they've used that halftime space instead of going into a generic ad break. They did ad-funded content telling the stories behind the teams, behind the places. You're giving people a reason to care about the teams, giving them that inside knowledge. So the whole thing packaged together. So yes, visibility is absolutely top, but it's everything around it as well that's had the impact that it has.
Yeah, I think, you know, the report has said that it's found that women's football is becoming a compelling and viable sporting and commercial proposition. Lindsay, in terms of that visibility that Charlotte's talked about, have you noticed that in your own experience so far in the last year or so?
Oh, I mean, 100%. Like, as a, you know, somebody who does watch football generally anyway, kind of the visibility of it has grown massively. And I think what excites me and interests me is, you know, you've got companies like DAZN and partnering with YouTube, which I think is a bit of a strange cross-pollination anyway, because, you know, in if you talk about it from like a CTV perspective, YouTube across Europe is the CTV industry. So DAZN as a CTV kind of subscription-based platform, SVOD platform, using YouTube to help grow its presence, visibility, its subscriptions is like a weird kind of cross-pollination type situation. But I think that what is interesting is what we don't really appreciate is that the role that all of these broadcasters, be they streaming services, be they public service broadcasters, the role they have to play in helping to grow a category. And so any investment that they make is almost like it's an investment in a sport. It's not an investment in their own channel, if that makes sense. Like, they are sometimes maybe even taking a hit to ensure that they are helping to grow a category and increase a category for all the reasons that Charlotte just mentioned, like, you know, helping young girls like get into kind of grassroots football, helping people understand that they can get more sporty, kind of helping grow things in different ways. And I think that the way that brands are working with this is what I find super interesting. Like what you just mentioned about Adidas kind of working to help people learn about the players and not just kind of go straight into a standard ad break. I think that we're in a situation now from a kind of TV perspective where there's so much opportunity to play around with formats. It's not just the standard, you know, you go onto Sky Sports on Saturday and you watch, you know, also, you watch Super Sunday on Sky Sports and you've got your standard football game. Then you've got all the same ads during the ad break. Normally they're Ray Winston talking about betting odds, and then you're back into the game again. Actually, what this is proving is that there is a completely different way of doing this, and it will really help us engage with a sport in a way that is kind of almost been forgotten about when it comes to men's football.
Just to add on to kind of your point about, you know, seeing women's football become like this viable play, and I think you made a really good point there, Lindsay, around not necessarily turning a profit at first and doing that as an investment piece, but I think what we're seeing, especially with DAZN, is that change of mindset. Instead of investing in women's football because it's the right thing to do, but understanding that actually it's a really smart thing to do. If you look at the UEFA business case for women's football that they released after the Euros last year, they cited that a third of new fans to women's football were new to football. So when you look at that as the growth of the game, we're not just looking at growing football fans, we're looking at bringing new fans into football. We see this a lot with the content that we put out across our social channels, where most of the time over 50% of the viewers are not followers of Copper 90. They have found us through women's football. So for us, we see it actually as a really smart thing to invest in, because for us, it's giving us a new way to grow. We've got to where we are very much in men's football, and now we're able to expand into this new fan base this new fan culture who engage with the game completely differently. As much as we'd like to think that DAZN have invested in women's football out of the goodness of their own heart, they absolutely haven't. They are looking to monetize it from next season, and absolutely as they should. So what they've done is taken that mindset as if we grow the interest and we really invest in it in the start, they're going to get the returns on that, because you are now going to get people wanting to subscribe because they're going to want to follow their teams, especially when you've got such like big transfers happening in the women's football market as well, and some big names going across to play in Europe, like we saw today, Eriksen and Harder, who have gone across to Munich, and you've got Lucy Bronze at Barcelona. You're starting to see these big names that people are sitting up and taking interest in. DAZN have absolutely had a big part to play in turning these players into superstars and creating that need, creating that want that now people are going to go and pay for it. So I think, yes, they have invested in it. And I don't know the ins and outs of their commercials, but I'm sure it was running at a loss at first. But now they're able to capitalize on it and actually have that, see it as that investment opportunity. And I think it's that change of mindset that brands really need to start thinking about, from that good cause to great opportunity, from the right thing to do to the smart thing to do.
I think that, you know, you discussed the brand opportunity and, you know, growing the players as brands and growing the clubs as brands as well, and how the DAZN and YouTube deal has helped to do that. And I think that moves us on quite nicely to the second story we're going to talk about, which is TikTok Lives, published by the Burnley FC Women, have accrued 1 million views. The achievement comes 2 years after the club forged a multi-season partnership with a short-form video platform, becoming the first team to stream games on the platform. The deal has also seen TikTok become Burnley Women's first shirt sleeve sponsor and provide unique training to make them a creator-first football team on the platform. According to TikTok, the partnership has helped the club strengthen its relationships with fans, reach new audiences, and receive more commercial opportunities. So, Charlotte, I'll come to you. Are new platforms like TikTok the way forward for football clubs as brands to build their online presence, and particularly a niche way for women's football to really make an impact?
Yeah, absolutely. This story just excites me so much. I think it's so smart, it's so clever, and it's such a great example of not copying and pasting what we're doing in the men's game and really harnessing the innovative nature of women's football, the fact that it's a new way to do things, it's a way to reinvent fandom, and the fact that fans are engaging in the game in different ways. So I think as a whole, it's super smart, it's super clever, and especially kind of putting that creator first lens. We did a piece of research recently looking at not only who the women's football fan is, but also looking at how they engage with the game. How does this differ from the men's game? And one of the big findings, unsurprisingly, that we found was the fact that women's football fans are found on socially driven social content, social community platforms, which makes sense when you think about it, kind of going back to what we were talking about in the last question of the visibility of women's football, where historically you would have to go online to follow the game. And then on top of that, to find your community, it's not like you can just walk into a pub with your mum. I'm a Spurs fan for my sins. If I walked into a pub with my Spurs shirt on during a women's football game, the chances are, unfortunately, that there's not necessarily going to be a whole load of people there that I can talk to, or they'll assume that I'm there for the men's team. Whereas if I walk in there during a men's game, I've immediately got my people, my community that I can speak to. So where do I go to find my women's football community? I go online. So I think whereas men's football started very linear, TV, radio, at the game, and then it's starting to move into this more socially driven platforms like TikTok. With women's football, what you're finding is it started from this social base and these social community driven platforms, and it's now the communities are starting to go from online to in real life, but it very much starts from there. So as a whole, it just makes sense that this partnership works. The next layer that I would add to that is how they follow women's football. And we found that women's football fans very much follow from a player first perspective. So historically, women's football fans are less tribalistic than men. Please don't confuse that with less passionate, because they're very different things. We talk about going to women's football games and you've got the atmosphere that more akin to a festival. You've still got that passion, that excitement, that amazing atmosphere. But it's not necessarily like the tribalistic nature that you would get the men's. So because of that, you find that a lot of fans will follow from a player first perspective. That could either be because they went to the Euros and they spotted players that they love. Like, for example, they saw Alyssa Russo score her amazing nutmeg goal. They fell in love with her. Now they follow Manchester United because that's where she plays. Then I think a really great example of that is recently when Jordan Nobbs moved from Arsenal to Aston Villa. and all of the Arsenal fans were really positive about it, and they were really pleased to see her go. And she just got her call up to the England squad that was announced yesterday, and the positive chat around it was amazing. So I think that really shows that you kind of got that player first, that player first mentality. Then, like the final layer to add is then how do they engage with the players, and that is with that content, personality driven content. They're not just interested in what happens on the pitch. They want to know the players' personalities. They want to know who they're friends with, who they're hanging out with, what music do they listen to. They really want to feel like they're in the know. So you put all of that together in terms of the insight of who is the women's football fan and how do they support, how do they follow their team and how do they follow their game. And then you put that through the lens of the Burnley sponsorship. It just makes sense why it works. It's not just the fact that there happen to be a million Burnley women fans out there. There might be, but I highly doubt that's where they came from. They came from the fact that they started to follow these stories. We know that TikTok is a platform that's meant for discovery. You don't need to be following someone to see their content. So it's a really smart way to grow and to get on people's streams. I talked a bit about kind of a storytelling before and making you care about things you didn't know that you care about. This is, in my opinion, a very smaller version of the Wrexham example. You know, it's not that all of a sudden a load of people in the US are diehard Wrexham fans. They've followed the story on Disney Plus. They love Ryan Reynolds. They love the story behind it. It's like on a smaller scale, that's what's happening here, where you've got the audience who has discovered Burnley women because they've turned their biggest assets, their players, their personalities, into creators. So people are falling in love with the players. They're falling in love with the story. So of course, they're then going to go and have that vested support and follow the game. And I think it's such a great example of women's football being a place where we can rewrite the rules of fandom, do something different, do something innovative, and take the game as a whole to the new level. It's not about when is it going to be as big as men's. I hate that question. It's we're going to be something completely different. And I can't wait to 10 years time when people are starting to talk about how we can make the men's game more like the women's.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to go, a lot to take from that and a lot to dive into, I think. I think rewriting the rules of fandom is a really interesting line and a really interesting proposition for women's football. Lindsay, what do you think it is about TikTok that has really helped this come alive? And in particular, this, you know, the Burnley women's team streaming their games. What do you think about that as a platform?
I mean, I think there's so many reasons why this works. And one thing that really resonates with me is what Charlotte was just saying about almost kind of recreating, reinventing the format. I think that TikTok and women's football, or I should say the popularity of women's football in terms of their recent successes, are both fairly nascent, and it gives them a chance to both kind of really start from the beginning. It's much easier to be brand new to something, be brand new in terms of popularity, working with a brand new platform and be able to kind of go, right, we've never done this before, what can we do? Versus men's football, which is very established in what their process is and how they promote things and kind of who they communicate with, and the way that the footballers themselves actually build their brands and build their online presence, that it would be very difficult for them to kind of go, okay, I need to start again and work out how I can communicate with the TikTok generation. Whereas these women's footballers can start this from scratch and kind of go, right, this is how I build my online presence. I think that makes it fascinating. Because I think TikTok in general, from a sporting perspective, I mean, you just mentioned Wrexham, Charlotte. I remember first seeing TikTok as a sleeve sponsor on Wrexham players and was like, oh, I didn't know TikTok was sponsoring football. That's interesting. And obviously they sponsored Wrexham for a good reason that Charlotte just outlined. You know, when you've got a football club owned by Ryan McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds, it's obvious why they're going to want to sponsor it. But I thought interesting for TikTok to be doing it on that way around. So they're actually sponsoring as well as trying to get players to use them as a platform and them working with the Burnley players to teach them how to communicate with their audience, teach them how to really make engaging posts and make the most of it, I think is a really interesting thing for TikTok to be doing. TikTok are bloody smart, right? They know what they're doing. They've done some really, we've had them on the podcast before, they've done some really interesting things with brands, and they've made brands that you wouldn't think would ever dream of going near TikTok, made them cool. Like Microsoft Teams, like Costa, like this, they've made them cool and kind of really kind of helped them engage with younger influencers. And Burnley are doing that with existing kind of well-known TikTok influencers already. This is fascinating for me. And I think that it struck me as well when I was watching Air, the kind of origin story of the Nike Air Jordans, that's available on Amazon Prime. If you haven't seen it, it's bloody brilliant. The clip that Sonny Vaccaro was watching over and over again of Michael Jordan in his early career, where he kind of just did a slam dunk shot and saying, right, just look it over and over again. It's like, if TikTok existed in that generation, that is what you'd be doing. You'd be capturing these kind of once in a lifetime moments that happen within sports and replaying them over and over again on short form video platforms like TikTok. And that's where I think it become really, really interesting for women's football to be able to kind of grow in a category like that. And I think as well that the, just the general power of sport on a platform like TikTok, they lend themselves so well together. Like I hate to keep talking about basketball because I'm obsessed with it and I don't even really watch basketball, but I've seen London Lions play at the Copper Box Arena in Stratford. And again, like as a fairly kind of up and coming in terms of popularity sport, they've done a really good job of encouraging everyone in the room and encouraging everyone watching on TV, when it is on TV, which is rarely, to engage with TikTok and to undertake videos and to kind of, and to promote the players and promote the atmosphere and the vibe in kind of short form, interesting ways. And I just think it's such an interesting and such a powerful way for women's football to be able to grow a community. We talked before about growing a category. This is a way to grow a community and build a community. And I think it's just going to be so interesting to see where it's at in 5 years' time. And as Charlotte said, see what men's football does to try to follow suit, because they'll be looking at women's football right now going, we need to do that. This is what we need to be getting on with. Come on, guys, start opening TikTok accounts. Let's see how we can match them.
Yeah, it's what you said, Lindsay, about, you know, they're both being in relatively nascent phases and growing together, and, you know, it being a new thing and it being just able to grow quite naturally, I think is really, really interesting. And it links quite nicely into next story, which is a bit more towards the legacy side of TV rights, which is that women's World Cup TV rights are currently hanging in the balance. FIFA President Gianni Infantino has threatened to ban coverage of the Women's World Cup in Europe after broadcasters make insufficient offers for the broadcast rights. According to media rights data from Ampere, global broadcast investment in women's sport is set to total £281.8 million this year, which is equivalent to less than 1% of the revenue accrued by TV sports rights. Coverage of the Women's World Cup had previously been included with those for the men's tournament until being spun out by the football governing body in 2021. Charlotte, how do you see the market for women's TV rights? I want to really pick up on the fact that it's only just been unbundled from the men's game, which, you know, it's probably about time, and it can exist as its own commercial entity now. How are you seeing this develop?
Gosh, it's such a tricky question, and it's such a tricky thing to explore, I think, especially when you don't know the ins and outs of, you know, we only really see what we read about, as opposed to, you know, what's actually going on. So I think it's a really hard one. I don't think it's quite as black and white as the broadcasters should be paying more or FIFA should be accepting less. But I do think you need to kind of take a holistic step back and look at the kind of whole marketplace as a whole. And very much, like you said, it's been unbundled from the men's for the first time. So, you know, are FIFA expecting too much? I think on the kind of broadcaster side, again, as you mentioned, you know, the likes of Sky and BBC and other local domestic broadcasters across Europe have invested heavily in women's football. So I don't think, again, there's that lack of want or need. But I think with the World Cup in Australia, before we look at the sort of wider like economic world and kind of the other factors that play in, just the fact that it's the other side of the world from Europe, kickoff times, whilst they have been moved to accommodate European countries. So I think for England, our kickoff times are 8, 10 and 11 in the morning. Yes, we will be, you know, we're not getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to watch them, but actually you're still going to be at work. You're still going to be at school. You're still not going to necessarily be around and have that same World Cup experience that you would do, that we did in 2019 when it was in France, or this summer when the Euros was here. I don't think that necessarily think that was the wrong thing to do. I think Europe have had loads of love when it comes to women's football, and it's right for the other side of the world, that for the Southern Hemisphere to get it. But I think that needs to be taken into consideration, because if the TV broadcasters are not expecting the same viewing figures as they've seen in the past, how can they be expected to pay the same amount for the rights? So I think that's the first thing that we need to look at. I think secondly, you then do need to look at the sort of wider economic turndown of the fact, you know, things like Brexit, the war in Ukraine, post-COVID, like we are in a very different economic world than we were in 2019. Saying that, I don't think that, you know, we didn't see the same the same arguments break out ahead of the Men's World Cup that was, you know, that just happened last year, and that's the same economic climate. So I don't know how much we can really use that as a reason. You just don't know. From a consumer point of view, the cost of living crisis will only really affect it from a subscription service point of view. And we know that it will be the free-to-air platforms that will be bidding for the rights. And then I guess from a BBC point of view, are the government, you know, they're getting less funding from the government, therefore are they going to have less money to spend? So there's all these different things that could potentially be affecting it. Then looking at it from a FIFA point of view, and I don't want this to turn into a FIFA bashing podcast.
I think
that's okay.
I'd be fine with that. John, are you fine with that?
I'm totally fine with that. Yeah.
Good. FIFA bashing.
I like to try and stay fairly neutral with my role. Not, you know, you do, the famous line, "Don't burn bridges." Although I guess there are some that you don't mind burning. but you know, if you listen to what Infantino was saying about his reasons why he's doing this, and actually the points are totally fair, you know, wanting to be, you know, we need to be valuing women's football as it is. They've broken out, they've broken, separated the rights so that it can be its own commercial entity. That makes sense. So if we're looking to if he's got ambitions to make the prize money equal, the only way that's going to happen is if broadcasters and sponsors invest into it. Yeah, that's where they're going to find the money. Or where they say they find the money, the fact that it was all bundled up, you know, previously, and the prize money was still considerably less, but you won't go into because that's not what we're talking about. However, you can kind of see where they're coming from, but then when you start to dig into the details, you know, they've tripled the prize fund for this summer's tournament, but it's still only 34% of what the men's get. So part of me is like, well, how can you sit there and say that the broadcasters are undervaluing women's football when, you know, yes, it's great that you've tripled it, and that we saw this with the FA with the FA Cup, where they significantly increased the women's FA Cup prize money. And these are great headlines, quadrupled it, tripled it. This is great. But actually, if the number that you're starting with is so small, you can triple £10. It's still only 30 quid. So it's quite interesting when you look at it from that point of view. But I think what we actually need to look at is take a step back and look at the wider impact that it's having, because you can tit for tat over whether FIFA should be accepting less money or the broadcasters should be paying more, and you could go around in circles all day. But actually, all that's happening is that the wider game is suffering. If you think of the marketing campaigns that aren't happening because broadcasters aren't able to promote, the sponsorships that aren't happening because brands are holding back because they think that ITV might have the coverage and they want to sponsor ITV's coverage. So that's money that they are not spending that could be going to other places. There's the other news around the fact that players have got brand blackouts from really, really early on. I think it's mid-June, where they're not allowed to talk around other brands. So that means that if, say, like BBC or ITV get the rights, they're going to have 2 weeks to do everything they need to do with their player ambassadors. Or if it's a brand who is sponsoring a player and the coverage, they're going to have a week to do everything. So you're starting to take away the earning rights of the players. If you want people to tune in and watch, you're taking away that build up, that marketing. So actually, you can go tit for tat whether, you know, how much it's going to be, and, you know, investing money back into the game for the future. But the here and now is actually what's suffering. And I think that's the most important thing, whether they pay X or Y for the rights. Right now, the important thing is it needs to get done, because the wider ecosystem surrounding the game is suffering.
Yeah, I mean, that's when you put it in those terms. Like, it would be horrible to see this Women's World Cup, which is a huge opportunity, become a lost opportunity. Lindsay, how are you seeing broadcasting spend being impacted? Is the cost of living crisis having an impact?
I mean, yes, it definitely will be. I think that the thing about men's football, you know, you could just argue men's sports in general, really, is that the cost of living crisis never really impacts in the same way. I think because they're such, it's such a sure thing. It's such a sure thing that they will know that they'll get the viewership. They know they've got the audience, and they'll know they'll get the sponsorship from the brands. Like that's, it's always like a clear thing. Whereas because of the nascency of the popularity of women's football, and the fact that it's only just been unbundled from the men's World Cup, and you know, I think Infantino is an idiot, but I have to question kind of, you know, from FIFA's perspective. Did they do that because they thought it was the right thing to do, or because they saw a revenue opportunity? And I think we have to remember they're a business after all, so it's definitely a revenue opportunity for them. And one of the reasons why he's kicking up such a fuss is because he was like, I thought we'd get millions for this, and they're offering us like 5 million. I thought we'd get like 20 million. And I think that what baffles me is that we're like 6-7 weeks away from the World Cup, and all the reasons Charlotte said about the fact that, you know, that just leaves any broadcaster. What if a broadcaster does end up taking this on? It gives them no time to be able to do anything with it. And that's what I don't understand. So they're going to start offering less money, not more money, to take on something that starts literally within a matter of weeks, because FIFA can't get their act together and say, okay, fine, we appreciate this is very new. And again, it goes back to kind of like the loss leader, you know, what DAZN are doing in terms of like investing in women's football as a loss leader, the starting point to kind of look at the revenue opportunity like later on. But I guess more generally, you know, World Cup rights are a one-time thing. So you're not investing in like 20 years of football. You're investing in the World Cup at that one moment in time. So what are you going to get out of it? I think that back to the question about, you know, broadcasting revenue outside of the BBC, which obviously is government and licensed payer funded, for people like ITV, they will... You know, let's be honest, they'll not get the same kind of advertiser interest in women's football that men's football would have got for the same time period, especially because the games are like between 8 and 10:30 a.m. And they're not going to want to invest more if they're not going to get the advertising revenue from it. Advertising revenue is so unbelievably important for that company. Why would they bother? But then I'm also thinking about the FIFA Plus aspect here and the FIFA Plus opportunity, because obviously... FIFA did launch their own ad-funded streaming platform, which is, as far as I'm aware, has almost like zero usage, like very, very small usage. I don't think most people even know it exists. But do FIFA see an opportunity to actually broadcast the games on that instead and try and have control over the distribution of World Cup football, control over the advertising revenue? You know, if it's aired on FIFA Plus, they'll get the ad revenue, as well as they won't get the broadcasting rights, but can they have more control over what money comes in from that side? So are they kind of, I have to wonder, have they worked out what revenue they could get if they published it, if they broadcast everything on FIFA Plus versus what they're expecting to get from a free-to-air broadcaster, and gone, well, we could probably get 10 million. So if they offer anything less than that, that's not worth our time. I don't know. Because I don't trust FIFA, I have to go down the route of... Thinking the worst at all times of that, of them.
It's such an interesting point, because if they do go down that route, are they going to put the same broadcasting quality, and coverage quality as you would get from a broadcaster? So, like, take the FA Player, for example, which streams every single WSL and Championship game on their player. And don't get me wrong, it's a great thing that they do, and it's great that you can access it. But because the quality is so poor, because it is just one camera with a finger that goes and wipes off the rain every now and again.
watching it in 8-bit.
Well, yeah. it's a great idea as a product. And it's where women's football fans have historically watched women's football. And I think to your point of the FA, of the FIFA Player, it makes sense in one way, because we as women's football fans are very used to going online and seeking out content. But actually, it deserves the quality broadcast. It deserves to have, I don't know loads about broadcasting, but in terms of like the number of cameras that you have, I know makes a big difference. Having the high quality pundits, having, you know, giving it the whole experience. It's not just about access to watching it. It's about having a high quality experience, because that's what you deserve as a football fan. You deserve to have the best pundits with the best stats and analytics, with the best coverage, with the best camera angles, with the best quality. And, you know, yes, you could push everyone onto the player, but they're not going to have a great experience. And how's that going to help the wider growth, or not even the growth, the wider commercial value of the game, if the product that you're putting out there is not of high quality? People are never going to pay for it next time round, or it's not going to attract new fans to it. So it's so much more than just having access at the additional costs. And I think that's also something else to take into consideration when you're thinking about how much these broadcasters need to pay. They're not just paying for the rights, they're paying to go to the other side of the world to produce content. So, you know, we're only sending a couple of people out there, because we can't send, we never cover matches. We're everything outside of the 90 minutes, but yeah, we're still sending a slimmer team out there. I know that the other broadcasters are thinking of broadcasting just from the UK. So I think, you know, there's so much to consider in terms of like the actual final product, and then also like the wider market. Like, are they going to invest millions of pounds into a massive multi-global market advertising campaign telling everybody where to watch it? Probably not. So again, that why you've got to think of football as a business, and you've got to think of it as this wider ecosystem that is underpinned by broadcasts and like broadcast rights and sponsorships. But actually, there is such a bigger ecosystem that surrounds the game. And when you take out a key cog such as broadcasting, the whole thing falls down around it.
We hope it gets resolved, because this tournament certainly deserves to have, you know, high quality, good coverage, and for everyone to be able to watch it as well.
It does.
Yeah, it's going to be a huge event. And as you've said, Charlotte, Copper 90, you're going to have a presence over there and you're going to be covering it. I'd like to hear a little bit more about your role at Copper 90 and what you're doing, what you're up to, and how you're seeing stuff at the moment. How is everything at Copper 90?
Well, it's 49 days out to a major tournament, so we're pretty busy. off the back of a double tournament year last year. So yeah, safe to say we are all systems go. So yeah, my role at Copper 90 is head of women's football, as I oversee the wider strategy of women's football at Copper 90, with a particular focus on commercial and helping brands engage with the women's football fans. So my job is kind of broken down into three different areas: understand the women's football audience, create entertainment for the women's football audience, and monetize the women's football audience. We don't have a women's football team at Copper 90, and that's something that we're very proud of. You are looking at her. We talk a lot about being at the heart of football fandom, and that is absolutely true for the men's and women's games. So I work with the editorial team, our media team, our insights team, our brand consultancy team, and feed in, whether I'm acting as a consultant with the brand team, driving our entertainment content forward, and providing our editorial teams with insight to help drive their content. So that's sort of what I do as a whole. Our focus at the moment is twofold. The first focus is absolutely the World Cup. We're very excited about what we're going to be doing out there. So we've got a few different ways that we will be showing up at the World Cup. So we will be on the ground with one of our Goals Talk presenters. Rihanna will be out there, essentially bottling up that big tournament energy and bringing it back to us. We're really excited about how that's going to work out. Then we will be in the studio. So we have a flagship show called Goals Talk, which is a social first chat show that's very much based on the culture of women's football. We talk a lot about shooting for platform, and that's very much what we do with Goals Talk. It's very much shot for the likes of TikTok and Insta Reels, where we have segments as opposed to a whole show that we do cut downs from. And we'll be turning the volume up on that over the World Cup, with having our other host Marva. We'll be joined by stars of both the women's football community, but also players, and that'll be going out nearly daily, I think, or at least every other day throughout the tournament. So we are planning that. And then the big activation that I'm really excited about is an activation called The World is Watching, And we are attempting to engage content creators from every single country of the 32 competing countries. And telling the World Cup story from their point of view. So whether it's fans that have travelled thousands and thousands of miles to go and watch on the ground, or fans that are staying up at 3 o'clock in the morning to watch their game, what is their fan experience? What does women's football fan culture look like around the world? And then on top of that, we're working with some pretty exciting brands that I can't talk about just yet, but watch the space. There are some super exciting things that are happening. Nice. Then outside of the World Cup, because we are looking at kind of women's football as a whole, we're looking at kind of building out our women's football community as a whole. We've got our flagship show, Goals Talk, that we're looking to grow into a wider community as well. And yeah, my big focus, now I've got everyone up and running on World Cup, is very much what we're doing next year, how we're keeping that conversation going, what is our day-to-day women's football conversation.
Amazing. And yeah, without, you know, you've said you're working with some big brands and stuff, and without naming any of names, since the Euros last year in particular, which was seen as, you know, a watershed event, really, particularly in this country with England winning, have you been approached by more brands to work on the women's side of women's football side of content? Has it become, have you noticed a real uptick in the viability of it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, yeah, the position that we were in this time last year versus now is chalk and cheese, really, with the amount of conversations that we're having. We have a number of almost in-house brands that we work pretty closely with, such as EA and Pepsi and Sports Direct, who we did some big activations for around the Euros. EA especially, we worked really closely with on bringing the women's domestic leagues into FIFA, which is soon to be EAFC, and we did a big piece of work with them on that, and we worked really closely with them on that. Then outside of that, yeah, the brand conversations we've had, I mean, looking at the briefs that we've had in through the door, I would say 80% at the moment are based on women's football. So yeah, seeing a real difference. And what's exciting is we're starting to see briefs come through that are not just, we want to help grow the game. They're very much, we want to explore the world of women's football fan culture. What's football plus music, football plus fashion? What does that look like? How can we can now kind of sit back and enjoy what women's football fan culture is and explore how women's football fans express their fandom through their subculture. So we're seeing a lot more of that come through as well. It's a really exciting time as brands are starting to look and feel their way around this new or evolving culture.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to hearing from you again in future and, you know, keeping up with all this. And we'll definitely be keeping up with Copper 90 over the Women's World Cup, which will be a huge event. And best of luck to you all with it.
Fab. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for joining us. And Lindsay, thank you as always.
Thank you. That was a really good chat. I really enjoyed that. Thank you, Charlotte.
And thank you very much all for listening. We have ATS London coming up in the next couple of weeks. Tickets are still available. Find them on exchangewire.com. And thank you very much.